days. He fell into a thoughtful mood. Francie kept skipping ahead and collecting leaves. They came upon the school, and Francie proudly showed it to Papa. The late afternoon sun warmed its softly colored bricks, and the small paned window seemed to dance in the sunshine. Johnny looked at it a long time. Then he said, "Yes, this is the school. This is it." Then, as whenever he was moved or stirred, he had to put it into a song. He held his worn derby over his heart, stood up straight, looking up at the schoolhouse, and sang,
School days,
dear old golden rule days, readin' and writin' and arithmetic. To a passing stranger, it might have looked silly. Johnny standing there in his greenish tuxedo and fresh linen, holding the hand of a thin, ragged child, and singing the banal song so unself-consciously on the street. But to Francie, it seemed right and beautiful. They crossed the street and wandered in the meadow that folks called lots. Francie picked a bunch of goldenrod and wild asters to take home. Johnny explained that the place had once been an Indian burying ground, and how, as a boy, he had often come there to hunt arrowheads. Francie suggested they hunt for some. They searched for half an hour and found none. Johnny recalled that as a boy, he hadn't found any either. This struck Francie as funny, and she laughed. Papa confessed that maybe it hadn't been an Indian cemetery after all. Maybe someone had made up that story. Johnny was more than right, because he had made up the whole story himself. Soon it was time to go home, and tears came into Francie's eyes because Papa hadn't said anything about getting her into the new school. He saw the tears and figured out a scheme immediately. "Tell you what we'll do, baby. We'll walk around and pick out a nice house and take down the number. I'll write a letter to your principal saying you're moving there and want to be transferred to this school." They found a house, a one-story white one, with a slanting roof and late chrysanthemums growing in the yard. He copied the address carefully. "You know that what we are going to do is wrong."
"Is it, Papa?"
"But it's a wrong to gain a bigger good."
"Like a white lie?"
"Like a lie that helps someone out. So you must make up for the wrong by being twice as good. You must never be bad or absent or late. You must never do anything to make them send a letter home through the mails."
"I'll always be good, Papa, if I can go to that school."
"Yes. Now I'll show you a way to go to school through a little park. I know right where it is." "Yes, sir, I know right where it is." He showed her the park and how she could walk through it diagonally to go to school. "That should make you happy. You can see the seasons change as you come and go. What do you say to that?" Francie, recalling something her mother had once read to her, answered,
"My cup runneth over."
And she meant it. When Katie heard of the plan, she said,
"Suit yourself, but I'll have nothing to do with it. If the police come and arrest you for giving a false address, I'll say honestly that I had nothing to do with it. One school's as good or as bad as another. I don't know why she wants to change. There's homework no matter what school you go to."
"It's settled then," Johnny said. "Francie, here's a penny. Run down to the candy store and get a sheet of writing paper and an envelope." Francie ran down and ran back. Johnny wrote a note saying Francie was going to live with relatives at such and such an address and wanted a transfer. He added that Neely would continue living at home and wouldn't require a transfer. He signed his name and underlined it authoritatively. Tremblingly, Francie handed the note to her principal next morning. That lady read it, grunted, made out the transfer, handed her her report card, and told her to go. That the school was too crowded anyhow. Francie presented herself and documents to the principal of the new school. He shook hands with her and said he hoped she'd be happy in the new school. A monitor took her to the classroom. The teacher stopped the work and introduced Francie to the class. Francie looked out over the rows of little girls. All were shabby, but most were clean. She was given a seat to herself and happily fell into the routine of the new school. The teachers and children here were not as brutalized as in the old school. Yes, some of the children were mean, but it seemed a natural child meanness and not a campaign. Often the teachers were impatient and cross, but never naggingly cruel. There was no corporal punishment either. The parents were too American, too aware of the rights granted them by their constitution, to accept injustices meekly. They could not be bulldozed and exploited as could the immigrants and the second-generation Americans.
Francie found that the different feeling in the school came mostly from the janitor. He was a ruddy white-haired man whom even the principal addressed as Mr. Jensen. He had many children and grandchildren of his own, all of whom he loved dearly. He was father to all children. On rainy days when children came to school soaked, he insisted that they be sent down to the furnace room to dry out. He made them take off their wet shoes and hung their wet stockings on a line to dry. The little shabby shoes stood in a row before the furnace. It was pleasant down in the furnace room. The walls were whitewashed, and the big red-painted furnace was a comforting thing. The windows were high up in the walls. Francie liked to sit there and enjoy the warmth and watch the orange and blue flames dancing an inch above the bed of small black coals. He left the furnace door open when the children were drying out. On rainy days, she left earlier and walked to school slower so that she would be soaking wet and rate the privilege of drying in the furnace room. It was unorthodox for Mr. Jensen to keep the children out of class to dry, but everyone liked and respected him too much to protest. Francie heard stories around the school concerning Mr. Jensen. She heard that he had been to college and knew more than the principal did. They said he had married, and when the children came, had decided that there was more money in being a school engineer than in being a school teacher. Whatever it was, he was liked and respected. Once Francie saw him in the principal's office. He was in his clean striped overalls, sitting there with his knees crossed and talking politics. Francie heard that the principal often came down to Mr. Jensen's furnace room to sit and talk for a few moments while he smoked a pipe full of tobacco. When a boy was bad, he wasn't sent to the principal's office for a licking. He was sent to Mr. Jensen's room for a talking to. Mr. Jensen never scolded a bad boy. He talked to him about his own youngest son, who was a pitcher on the Brooklyn team. He talked about democracy and good citizenship and about a good world where everyone did the best he could for the common good of all. After a talk with Mr. Jensen, the boy could be counted upon not to cause any more trouble. At graduation, the children asked the principal to sign the first page of their autograph book out of respect to his position, but they valued Mr. Jensen's autograph more, and he always got the second page to sign. The principal signed quickly in a great sprawling hand. But not Mr. Jensen. He made a ceremony out of it. He took the book over to his big roll-top desk and lit the light over it. He sat down, carefully polished his spectacles, and chose a pen. He dipped it in ink, squinted at it, wiped it off, and re-dipped it. Then he signed his name in a fine steel engraving script and blotted it carefully. His signature was always the finest in the book. If you had the nerve to ask him, he'd take the book home and ask his son, who was with the Dodgers, to sign it too. This was a wonderful thing for the boys. The girls didn't care. Mr. Jensen's handwriting was so wonderful that he wrote out all the diplomas by request. Mr. Morton and Miss Burnstone came to that school, too. When they were teaching, Mr. Jensen would often come in and squeeze himself into one of the back seats and enjoy the lesson, too. On a cold day, he'd have Mr. Morton or Miss Burnstone come down to his furnace room for a hot cup of coffee before they went on to the next school. He had a gas plate and coffee-making equipment on a little table. He served strong, hot black coffee in thick cups, and these visiting teachers blessed his good soul. Francie was happy in this school. She was very careful about being a good girl. Each day, as she passed the house whose number she claimed, she looked at it with gratitude and affection. On windy days, when papers blew before it, she went about picking up the debris and depositing it in the gutter before the house. Mornings after the rubbish man had emptied the burlap bag and had carelessly tossed the empty bag on the walk instead of in the yard, Francie picked it up and hung it on a fence paling. The people who lived in the house came to look on her as a quiet child who had a queer complex about tidiness. Francie loved that school. It meant that she had to walk 48 blocks each day, but she loved the walk, too. She had to leave earlier in the morning than Neely, and she got home much later. She didn't mind, except that it was a little hard at lunchtime. There were 12 blocks to come home and 12 to go back, all in the hour. It left little time for eating. Mama wouldn't let her carry a lunch. Her reason was, she'll be weaned away from her home and family soon enough the way she's growing up, but while she's still a child, she has to act like a child and come home and eat the way children should. Is it my fault that she has to go so far to school? Didn't she pick it out herself? But Katie, argued Papa, it's such a good school. Then let her take the bad along with this good. The lunch question was settled. Francie had about 5 minutes for lunch, just time enough to report home for a sandwich which she ate walking back to school. She never considered herself put upon. She was so happy in the new school that she was anxious to pay in some way for this joy. It was a good thing that she got herself into this other school. It showed her that there were other worlds beside the world she had been born into, and that these other worlds were not unattainable. Francie counted the years passing, not by the days or the months, but by the holidays that came along. Her year started with the 4th of July, because it was the first holiday that came along after school closed. A week before the day, she began accumulating firecrackers. Every available penny went for packets of small crackers. She hoarded them in a box under the bed. At least 10 times a day, she'd take the box out, rearrange the fireworks, and look long at the pale red tissue and white corded stem, and wonder about how they were made. She smelled the thick bit of punk which was given gratis with each purchase, and which, when lit, smoldered for hours and was used to set off the firecrackers. When the great day came, she was reluctant to set them off. It was better to have them than to use them. One year, when times were harder than usual and pennies could not be had, Francie and Neely hoarded paper bags and, on the day, filled them with water, twisted the tops shut, and dropped them from the roof onto the street below. They made a nice plop, which was almost like a firecracker. Passers-by were irritated and looked up angrily when a bag just missed them, but they did nothing about it, excepting the fact that poor children had a custom of celebrating the 4th that way. The next holiday was Halloween. Neely blackened his face with soot, wore his cap backwards, and his coat inside out. He filled one of his mother's long black stockings with ashes and roamed the streets with his gang swinging his homely blackjack and crying out raucously from time to time. Francie, in company with other little girls, roamed the streets carrying a bit of white chalk. She went about drawing a large, quick cross on the back of each coated figure that came by. The children performed the ritual without meaning. The symbol was remembered, but the reason forgotten. It may have been something that had survived from the Middle Ages, when houses and probably individuals were so marked to indicate where plague had struck. Probably the ruffians of that time so marked innocent people as a cruel joke, and the practice had persisted down through the centuries to be distorted into a meaningless Halloween prank. Election Day seemed the greatest holiday of all to Francie. It, more than any other time, belonged to the whole neighborhood. Maybe people voted in other parts of the country, too, but it couldn't be the way it was in Brooklyn, thought Francie. Johnny showed Francie an oyster house on Skoll Street. It was housed in a building that had been standing there more than 100 years before, when Big Chief Tammany himself skulked around with his braves. Its oyster fries were known throughout the state. But there was something else that made this place famous. It was the secret meeting place of the great City Hall politicians. The party sachems met here in secret powwow in a private dining room, and over succulent oysters they decided who'd be elected and who mowed down. Francie often passed by the store, looked at it, and was thrilled. It had no name over its door, and its window was empty save for a potted fern and a half-curtain of brown linen run on brass rods along the back of it. Once, Francie saw the door open to admit someone. She had a glimpse of a low room dimly lit with dulled red-shaded lamps and thick with the smoke of cigars. Francie, along with the other neighborhood children, went through some of the election rites without knowing their meaning or reason. On election night, she got in line, her hands on the shoulders of the child in front, and snake-danced through the street singing, "Tammany, Tammany, Big Chief sits in his teepee, cheering braves to victory. Tammany, Tammany." She was an interested listener at the debates between Mama and Papa on the merits and faults of the party. Papa was an ardent Democrat, but Mama just didn't care. Mama criticized the party and told Johnny he was throwing his vote away. "Don't say that, Katie," he protested. "By and large, the party does a lot of good for the people." "I can just imagine," sniffed Mama. "All they want is a vote from the man in the family. And look what they give in exchange." "Name one thing they give." "Well, you need advice on a legal matter. You don't need a lawyer. Just ask your assemblyman." "The blind leading the blind." "Don't you believe it. They may be dumb in many ways, but they know the city statutes backwards and forwards. Sue the city for something and see how far Tammany will help you." "Take civil service," said Johnny, starting on another angle. "They know when the examinations for cops, firemen, or letter carriers are coming up. They'll always put a voter wise if he's interested." "Mrs. Levy's husband took the examination for letter carrier 3 years ago. He's still working on a truck."
Ah, that's because he's a Republican. If he was a Democrat, they'd take his name and put it on the top of the list. I heard about a teacher who wanted to be transferred to another school. Tammany fixed it up.
Why? Unless she was pretty.
That's not the point. It was a shrewd move. Teachers are educating future voters. This teacher, for instance, will always say a good word for Tammany to her pupils whenever she can. Every boy has to grow up to vote, you know.
Why?
Because it's a privilege.
Privilege?
Sneered Katie. Now, for instance, if you had a poodle and it died, what would you do?
What would I do with a poodle in the first place?
Can't you make out like you have a dead poodle just for the sake of conversation?
All right, my poodle's dead. Now what?
You go around to headquarters and the boys will take it away for you. Suppose Francie wanted to get working papers but was too young.
They'd get them, I suppose?
Certainly.
Do you think that's right to fix it so little children can work in factories?
Well, supposing you had a bad boy who played hooky from school and was getting to be a loafer hanging around street corners, but the law wouldn't let him work. Wouldn't it be better if he got faked working papers?
In that case, yes, conceded Katie.
Look at all the jobs they get for voters.
You know how they get them, don't you? They inspect a factory and overlook the fact that they're violating the factory laws. Naturally, the boss pays back by letting them know when they need men, and Tammany gets all the credit for finding jobs.
Here's another case. A man has relatives in the old country, but he can't get them over here on account of a lot of red tape. Well, Tammany can fix that up.
Sure, they get them foreigners over here and see to it that they start in on their citizenship papers and then tell them they must vote the Democratic ticket or go back where they came from.
No matter what you say, Tammany's good to the poor people. Say a man's been sick and can't pay his rent. Do you think the organization would let the landlord dispossess him?
No, sir. Not if he's a Democrat.
I suppose the landlords are all Republicans, then, Katie said.
No, the system works both ways. Suppose the landlord has a bum for a tenant who gives him a punch in the nose instead of the rent. What happens? The organization dispossesses him for the landlord.
For what Tammany gives to the people, it takes from them double.
You wait until less women vote.
Johnny's laugh interrupted her.
You don't believe we will?
That day will come, mark my words. We'll put all those crooked politicians where they belong, behind iron bars.
If that day ever comes when women vote, you'll go along to the polls with me, arm in arm, and vote the way I do.
He put his arm around her and gave her a quick hug. Katie smiled up at him.
Francie couldn't help noticing that Mama was smiling sidewise, the way the lady did in the picture in the school auditorium, the one they called Mona Lisa.
Tammany owed much of its power to the fact that it got the children young and educated them in the party ways. The dumbest ward healer was smart enough to know that time, no matter what else it did, passed, and that the schoolboy of today was the voter of tomorrow. They got the boys on their side, and the girls, too. A woman couldn't vote in those days, but the politicians knew that the women of Brooklyn had a great influence on their men. Bring a little girl up in the party way, and when she married, she'd see to it that her man voted the straight Democratic ticket. To woo the children, the Maddie Mahoney Association ran an excursion for them and their parents each summer. Although Katie had nothing but contempt for the organization, she saw no reason why they shouldn't take advantage of the good time. When Francie heard that they were going, she was as excited as only a 10-year-old who had never been on a boat before could be. Johnny refused to go and couldn't see why Katie wanted to go.
"I'm going because I like life,"
was her strange reason. "If that racket's life, I wouldn't take it with coupons," he said. But he went, anyhow. He figured the boat trip might be educational, and he wanted to be on hand to educate the children. It was a hot, sweltering day. The decks teemed with kids, wild with excitement, racing up and down and trying to fall into the Hudson River. Francie stared and stared at the moving water until she worked up the first headache of her life. Johnny told his children how Henrik Hudson had sailed up that same river so long ago. Francie wondered whether Mr. Hudson got sick to his stomach like she did. Mama sat on deck looking very pretty in her jade-green straw hat and a yellow-dotted Swiss dress that she had borrowed from Aunt Evie. People around her were laughing. Mama was a vivid conversationalist, and people liked to hear her talk. Soon after noon, the boat docked at a wooded glen upstate, and the Democrats got off the boat and took over. The kids ran around spending their tickets. The week before, each child had been given a strip of 10 tickets labeled hot dog, soda water, merry-go-round, and so on.
Francie and Neely had each been given a strip, but Francie had been tempted by some shrewd boys into gambling her tickets in a marble game. They had told her how she might possibly win 50 strips and have a grand day on the excursion. Francie was a poor marble player and quickly lost her tickets. Neely, on the other hand, had 3 strips. He had been lucky. Francie asked Mama could she have one of Neely's tickets. Mama seized the opportunity to give her a lecture on gambling. You had tickets, but you thought you could be smart and get something you weren't entitled to. When people gamble, they think only of winning. They never think of losing. Remember this. Someone has to lose, and it's just as apt to be you as the other fellow. If you learn this lesson by giving up a strip of tickets, you're paying cheap for the education. Mama was right. Francie knew she was right, but it didn't make her happy at all. She wanted to go on the merry-go-round like the other kids. She wanted a drink of soda. She was standing disconsolately near the hot dog stand watching other children stuff themselves when a man paused to speak to her. He wore a policeman's uniform, only with more gold on it.
"No tickets, little girl," he asked.
"I forgot them," lied Francie.
"Sure, and I was no good at marbles meself, as a boy."
He pulled 3 strips from his pocket. "We count on making up a certain number of losses each year, but it's seldom the girls are the losing ones. They hang on to what they have, be it ever so little." Francie took the tickets, thanked him, and was backing off when he asked, "Would that be your mother sitting over there in the green hat?"
"Yes,"
she waited. He said nothing. Finally she asked,
"Why?"
"Do you be saying your prayers to the little flower each night, asking that you grow up half as pretty as your mother? Do that now."
"And that's my papa next to my mama."
Francie waited to hear him say that papa was good-looking too. He stared at Johnny and said nothing. Francie ran off. Francie was instructed to report back to her mother at half-hour intervals during the day. At the next interval, when Francie came back, Johnny was over at the free beer keg. Mama teased her. "You like Aunt Sissy? Always talking to men in uniform."
"He gave me extra tickets."
"I saw." Katie's next words were casual enough.
"What did he ask you?"
"He asked, was you my mama?" Francie did not tell her what he said about Mama being pretty.
"Yes, I thought he was asking that."
Katie stared at her hands. They were rough and red and cut into with cleansing fluids. She took a pair of mended cotton gloves from her purse. Although it was a hot day, she pulled them on. She sighed. "I work so hard. Sometimes I forget that I'm a woman." Francie was startled. It was the nearest thing to a complaint she had ever heard from Mama. She wondered why Mama was ashamed of her hands all of a sudden. As she skipped away, she heard Mama ask the lady next to her, "Who's that man over there, the one in the uniform looking this way?"
"That would be Sergeant Michael McShane."
"It's funny you don't know who he is, seeing that it's from your own precinct he is."
The day of joy went on. There was a keg of beer set up at the end of each long table, and it was free to all good Democrats. Francie was caught up in the excitement and tore around, screamed and fought like the other children. Beer flowed like a Brooklyn gutter after a rainstorm. A brass band played doggedly. It played "The Kerry Dancers" and "When Irish Eyes Are Smiling" and "Harrigan, That's Me." It played "The River Shannon" and New York's own folk song, "The Sidewalks of New York." The conductor announced each selection.
"Maddie Mahoney's band will now play."
Each song ended with the band members shouting in unison,
"Hooray for Maddie Mahoney!"
With each glass of beer drawn, the attendant said, "Compliments of Maddie Mahoney." Each event was labeled the Maddie Mahoney Foot Race, the Mahoney Peanut Race, and so on. Before the day was over, Francie was convinced that Maddie Mahoney was a very great man indeed. Late in the afternoon, Francie got the idea that she ought to find Mr. Mahoney and thank him personally for a very nice time. She searched and searched, and asked, and a strange thing happened. No one knew Maddie Mahoney. No one had ever seen him. Certainly he was not at the picnic. His presence was felt everywhere, but the man was invisible. Some man told her that maybe there was no Maddie Mahoney. It was just the name they gave to whatever man was head of the organization.
"I've been voting the straight ticket for 40 years, he said. "Seems like the candidate was always the same man, Maddie Mahoney, or else it was a different man, but with the same name. I don't know who he is, girlie. All I know is that I vote the straight Democratic ticket."
The trip home down the moonlit Hudson was notable only for the many fights that broke out among the men. Most of the children were sick and sunburnt and fretful. Neely fell asleep on Mama's lap. Francie sat on the deck and listened to Mama and Papa talking. "Do you happen to know Sergeant McShane?" Katie asked. "I know who he is. They call him the Honest Cop. The party has its eye on him. It wouldn't surprise me if he was put up for assemblyman." A man sitting nearby leaned forward and touched Johnny's arm. "Police Commissioner is more like it, Mac," he said. "What about his life?" Katie asked. "It's like one of those Alger stories. He came from Ireland 25 years ago with nothing but a trunk small enough to be carried on his back. He worked as a dock walloper, studied nights, and got on the force. He kept on studying and taking examinations and finally got to be sergeant," said Johnny. "I suppose he's married to an educated woman who helped him?" "Matter of fact, no. When he first came over, an Irish family took him in and kept him till he got on his feet. The daughter of the family married a bum who ran out on her after the honeymoon and got himself killed in a brawl. Well, the girl was going to have a baby, and you couldn't make the neighbors believe she had ever been married. Seems like the family would be disgraced, but McShane married her and gave the child his name to kind of repay the family. It wasn't a love marriage exactly, but he's been very good to her, I hear."
"Did they have children together?"
14, I heard."
14?
"But he only raised 4. Seemed like they all died before they grew up. They were all born with consumption, you know. Inherited it from their mother, who had it from a girl." "He's had more than his share of trouble," mused Johnny. "And he's a good man."
"She's still alive, I suppose?"
"But very sick. They say she hasn't long to live."
"Oh, those kind hang on." "Katie!"
Johnny was startled by his wife's remark.
"I don't care. I don't blame her for marrying a bum and having a child by him. That's her privilege. But I do blame her for not taking her medicine when the time came due. Why did she put her troubles off onto a good man?"
"That's no way to talk."
"I hope she dies, and dies soon." "Hush, Katie!" "Yes, I do. So that he can marry again. Marry a cheerful, healthy woman who'll give him children that can live. That's every good man's right."
Johnny said nothing. A nameless fear had grown within Francie while she listened to her mother talking. Now she got up and went over to Papa, took his hand and pressed it hard. In the moonlight, Johnny's eyes flew open in startled surprise. He pulled the child to him and held her tightly. But all he said was, "Look how the moon walks on the water." Soon after the picnic, the organization began to prepare for election day. They distributed shiny white buttons with Maddie's mug on them to the neighborhood kids. Francie got some and stared long at the face. Maddie had grown so mysterious to her that he took the place of someone like the Holy Ghost. He was never seen, but his presence was felt. The picture was of a bland-faced man with roached hair and handlebar mustaches. It looked like the face of any small-time politician. Francie wished she could see him, just once, in the flesh. There was a lot of excitement about these buttons. The children used them for trading purposes, for games and coin of the realm. Neely sold his top to a boy for 10 buttons. Gimpy, the candy store man, redeemed 15 of Francie's buttons for a penny's worth of candy. He had an arrangement with the organization whereby he got the money back for the buttons. Francie went around looking for Maddie and found him all over. She found boys playing pitch games with his face. She found him flattened out on a car track to make a miniature potsy. He was in the debris of Neely's pocket. She peered down the sewer and saw him floating face upward. She found him in the sour soil at the bottoms of gratings. She saw Punky Perkins next to her in church drop 2 buttons in the plate in lieu of the 2 pennies his mother had given him. She saw him go into the candy store and buy 4 sweet Caporal cigarettes with the 2 cents after Mass. She saw Maddie's face everywhere, but she never saw Maddie. The week before election, she went around with Neely and the boys gathering lection, which was what they called the lumber for the big bonfires which would be lighted election night. She helped store the lection in the cellar. She was up early on election day and saw the man who came and knocked on the door. When Johnny answered, the man said, "Nolan?"
"Yes," admitted Johnny. "At the polls, 11 o'clock. He checked Johnny's name on his list.
He handed Johnny a cigar. Compliments of Maddie Mahoney. He went on to the next Democrat.
"Wouldn't you go anyhow without being told?" Francie asked.
"Yes, but they give us each a time so that the voting is staggered.
You know, not everyone coming in a bunch.
Why?
Persisted Francie. 'Cause, Johnny evaded.
I'll tell you why, broke in Mama. They want to keep tabs on who's voting and how. They know when each man's due at the polls, and God help him if he doesn't show up to vote for Maddie.
Women don't know anything about politics, said Johnny, lighting up Maddie's cigar.
Francie helped Neely drag their wood out on election night. They contributed it to the biggest bonfire on the block. Francie got in line with the other children and danced around the fire Indian fashion, singing Tammany. When the fire had burned down to embers, the boys raided the pushcarts of the Jewish merchants and stole potatoes which they roasted in the ashes. So cooked, they were called Mickeys. There weren't enough to go around, and Francie didn't get any. She stood on the street watching the returns come in on a bedsheet stretched from window to window of a house on the corner. A magic lantern across the street threw the figures on the sheet. Each time new returns came in, Francie shouted with the other kids, "Another country heard from!" Maddie's picture appeared on the screen from time to time, and the crowd cheered itself hoarse. A Democratic president was elected that year, and the Democratic governor of the state was re-elected, but all that Francie knew was that Maddie Mahoney got in again. After election, the politicians forgot their promises and enjoyed an earned rest until New Year when they started work on the next election. January 2nd was Ladies' Day at Democratic headquarters. On that day, and no other, ladies were received into the strictly masculine precinct and treated to sherry wine and little seeded cakes. All day, the ladies kept calling and were received gallantly by Maddie's henchmen. Maddie himself never showed up. As the ladies went out, they left their little decorated cards with their names written on them in the cut-glass dish on the hall table. Katie's contempt for the politicians did not interfere with her making her yearly call. She put on her brushed and pressed gray suit with all the braid on it and tilted her jade-green velvet hat over her right eye. She even gave the penman, who set up temporary shop outside headquarters, a dime to make a card for her. He wrote Mrs. John Nolan with flowers and angels crawling out of the capitals. It was a dime that should have gone into the bank, but Katie figured she could be extravagant once a year. The family awaited her homecoming. They wanted to hear all about the call.
"How was it this year?" asked Johnny.
"The same as always. The same old push was there. A lot of women had new clothes, which I bet they bought on time.
Of course the prostitutes were the best dressed," said Katie in her forthright way,
"and like always they outnumbered the decent women 2 to 1.
Johnny was one for taking notions. He'd take a notion that life was too much for him and start drinking heavier to forget it. Francie got to know when he was drinking more than usual. He walked straighter coming home. He walked carefully and slightly sidewise. When he was drunk, he was a quiet man. He didn't brawl. He didn't sing. He didn't grow sentimental. He grew thoughtful. People who didn't know him thought that he was drunk when he was sober, because sober he was full of song and excitement. When he was drunk, strangers looked on him as a quiet, thoughtful man who minded his own business. Francie dreaded the drinking periods, not on moral grounds, but because Papa wasn't a man she knew then. He wouldn't talk to her or to anybody. He looked at her with the eyes of a stranger. When Mama spoke to him, he turned his head away from her. When he got over a drinking time, he'd take a notion that he had to be a better father to his children. He felt that he had to teach them things. He'd stop drinking for a while, take a notion to work hard, and devote all his spare time to Francie and Neely. He had the same idea that Katie's mother, Mary Romilly, had about education. He wanted to teach his children all that he knew so that at 14 or 15 they would know as much as he knew at 30. He figured they could go on from there picking up their own knowledge, and according to his calculations, when they reached 30, they would be twice as smart as he had been at 30. He felt that they needed lessons in, for what passed in his mind, geography, civics, and sociology. So he took them over to Bushwick Avenue. Bushwick Avenue was the high-toned boulevard of old Brooklyn. It was a wide, tree-shaded avenue, and the houses were rich and impressively built of large granite blocks with long stone stoops. Here lived the big-time politicians, the moneyed brewery families, the well-to-do immigrants who had been able to come over first class instead of steerage. They had taken their money, their statuary, and their gloomy oil paintings, and had come to America and settled in Brooklyn. Automobiles were coming into use, but most of these families still clung to their handsome horses and magnificent carriages. Papa pointed out and described the various equipages to Francie. She watched in awe as they rolled by.
There were small, lacquered, dainty ones lined with tufted white satin, with a large fringed umbrella that was used by fine and delicate ladies. There were adorable wicker ones with a bench along each side, on which lucky children sat while they were pulled along by a Shetland pony. She stared at the capable-looking governesses who accompanied these children, women from another world, in capes and starch-string bonnets, who sat sideways on the seat to drive the pony. Francie saw practical black two-seaters drawn by a single high-stepping horse, controlled by dandified young men in kid gloves, with edges turned back to look like inverted cuffs. She saw staid family vehicles drawn by dependable-looking teams. These coaches did not impress Francie very much, because every undertaker in Williamsburg had a string of them. Francie liked the hansom cabs best. How magic they were with only two wheels, and that funny door that closed by itself when a passenger sat back in the seat. Francie thought in her innocence that the doors were meant to protect the passengers from flying horse manure. If I were a man, thought Francie, that's the job I'd like to have, driving one of them. Oh, to sit high up in the back with a brave whip and a socket close to hand. Oh, to wear such a great coat with large buttons and a velvet collar and a squashed-down high hat with a ribbon cockade in the band. Oh, to have such an expensive-looking blanket folded over her knees. Francie imitated the driver's cry under her breath.
Carriage, sir? Carriage?
Anybody, said Johnny, carried away by his personal dream of democracy, can ride in one of those handsome cabs, provided, he qualified, they got the money. So you can see what a free country we got here.
What's free about it if you have to pay? Asked Francie.
It's free in this way. If you have the money, you're allowed to ride in them, no matter who you are. In the old country, certain people aren't free to ride in them, even if they have the money.
Wouldn't it be more of a free country, persisted Francie, if we could ride in them free?
No.
Why?
Because that would be socialism, concluded Johnny triumphantly, and we don't want that over here.
Why?
Because we got democracy, and that's the best thing there is, clinched Johnny. There were rumors that New York City's next mayor would come from Bushwick Avenue, Brooklyn. The idea stirred Johnny. Look up and down this block, Francie, and show me where our future mayor lives. Francie looked, then had to hang her head and say,
I don't know, Papa.
There, announced Johnny as though he were blowing a trumpet fanfare. Someday that house over there will have two lampposts at the bottom of the stoop, and no matter where you roam in this great city, he orated, and you come across a house with two lampposts, you'll know that the mayor of the greatest city in the world lives there.
What will he need two lampposts for? Francie wanted to know.
Because this is America, and in a country where such things are, concluded Johnny vaguely, but very patriotically. You know that the government is by the people, for the people, of the people, and shall not perish from the face of the earth the way it does in the old countries. He began to sing under his breath. Soon he was carried away by his feeling and started to sing louder. Francie joined in. Johnny sang, You're a grand old flag, you're a high-flying flag, and forever in peace may you wave. People stared at Johnny curiously, and one kind lady threw him a penny. Francie had another memory about Bushwick Avenue. It was tied up with the scent of roses. There were roses, roses, Bushwick Avenue. Streets emptied of traffic, crowds on the sidewalk, the police holding them back, always the scent of roses. Then came the cavalcade, mounted policemen and a large open motor car in which was seated a genial, kindly-looking man with a wreath of roses around his neck. Some people were weeping with joy as they looked at him. Francie clung to Papa's hand. She heard people around her talking.
Just think, he was a Brooklyn boy, too.
Was? You dope, he still lives in Brooklyn.
Yeah?
Yeah, and he lives right here on Bushwick Avenue.
Look at him, look at him, a woman cried out. He did such a great thing, and he's still an ordinary man like my husband, only better looking.
It must have been cold up there, said a man.
It wonders me he didn't freeze his what's-his off, said a bawdy boy.
A cadaverous-looking man tapped Johnny on the shoulder. Mac, he inquired, do you actually believe there's a pole up there sticking out on top of the world?
Sure, answered Johnny. Didn't he go up there and turn around and hang the American flag on it?
Just then, a small boy hollered out,
Here he comes!
Ah! Oh.
Francie was thrilled by the sound of admiration that swayed the crowd when the car came past where they were standing. Carried away by the excitement, she yelled out shrilly, "Hooray for Dr. Cook! Hooray for Brooklyn!"
Most children brought up in Brooklyn before the First World War remember Thanksgiving Day there with a peculiar tenderness. It was the day children went around ragamuffin, or slamming gates, wearing costumes topped off by a penny mask. Francie chose her mask with great care. She bought a yellow Chinaman one with sleazy rope mandarin mustaches. Neely bought a chalk-white death head with grinning black teeth. Papa came through at the last minute with a penny tin horn for each, red for Francie, green for Neely. What a time Francie had getting Neely into his costume. He wore one of Mama's discarded dresses hacked off ankle length in front to enable him to walk. The uncut back made a dirty, dragging train. He stuffed wadded newspaper in the front to make an enormous bust. His broken-out brass-tipped shoes stuck out in front of the dress. Lest he freeze, he wore a ragged sweater over the ensemble. With this costume, he wore the death mask and one of Papa's discarded derbies, cocked on his head. Only it was too big and wouldn't cock and rested on his ears. Francie wore one of Mama's yellow waists, a bright blue skirt, and a red sash. She held the Chinaman mask on by a red bandana over her head and tied under her chin. Mama made her wear her zitful cap, Katie's own name for a wool stocking cap, over her headgear because it was a cold day. Francie put two walnuts for decoys in her last year's Easter basket and the children set out. The street was jammed with masked and costumed children making a deafening din with their penny tin horns. Some kids were too poor to buy a penny mask. They had blackened their faces with burnt cork. Other children with more prosperous parents had store costumes, sleazy Indian suits, cowboy suits, and cheesecloth Dutch maiden dresses. A few indifferent ones simply draped a dirty sheet over themselves and called it a costume. Francie got pushed in with a compact group of children and went the rounds with them. Some storekeepers locked their doors against them, but most of them had something for the children. The candy store man had hoarded all broken bits of candy for weeks and now passed it out in little bags for all who came begging. He had to do this because he lived on the pennies of the youngsters and he didn't want to be boycotted. The bakery stores obliged by baking up batches of soft, doughy cookies which they gave away. Children were the marketers of the neighborhood and they would only patronize those stores that treated them well. The bakery people were aware of this. The greengrocer obliged with decaying bananas and half-rotted apples. Some stores which had nothing to gain from the children neither locked them out nor gave them anything save a profane lecture on the evils of begging. These people were rewarded by terrific and repeated bangings of the front door by the children, hence the term slamming gates. By noon it was all over. Francie was tired of her unwieldy costume. Her mask had crumpled. It was made of cheap gauze, heavily starched and dried in shape over a mold. A boy had taken her tin horn and broken it in two across his knee. She met Neely coming along with a bloody nose. He had been in a fight with another boy who wanted to take his basket. Neely wouldn't say who won, but he had the other boy's basket besides his own. They went home to a good Thanksgiving dinner of pot roast and homemade noodles and spent the afternoon listening to Papa reminisce how he had gone around Thanksgiving Day as a boy. It was at a Thanksgiving time that Francie told her first organized lie, was found out, and determined to become a writer. The day before Thanksgiving, there were exercises in Francie's room. Each of four chosen girls recited a Thanksgiving poem and held in her hand a symbol of the day. One held an ear of dried-up corn, another a turkey's foot, meant to stand for the whole turkey. A third girl held a basket of apples, and the fourth held a 5-cent pumpkin pie, which was the size of a small saucer. After the exercises, the turkey foot and corn were thrown into the wastebasket. Teacher set aside the apples to take home. She asked if anyone wanted the little pumpkin pie. 30 mouths watered, 30 hands itched to go up into the air, but no one moved. Some were poor, many were hungry, and all were too proud to accept charitable food. When no one responded, teacher ordered the pie thrown away. Francie couldn't stand it, that beautiful pie thrown away, and she had never tasted pumpkin pie. To her, it was the food of covered wagon people, of Indian fighters. She was dying to taste it. In a flash, she invented a lie and up went her hand. "I'm glad someone wants it," said teacher. "I don't want it for myself," lied Francie proudly. "I know a very poor family I'd like to give it to." "Good," said teacher. "That's the real Thanksgiving spirit." Francie ate the pie while walking home that afternoon.
Whether it was her conscience or the unfamiliar flavor, she didn't enjoy the pie. It tasted like soap. The Monday following, teachers saw her in the hall before class and asked her how the poor family had enjoyed the pie. "They liked it a whole lot," Francie told her. Then when she saw teacher there looking so interested, she embellished the story. "This family has two little girls with golden curls and big blue eyes." "And?" prompted teacher.
And
they're twins."
"How interesting."
Francie was inspired. "One of them has the name Pamela and the other Camilla." These were names that Francie had once chosen for her non-existent dolls.
"And they are very, very poor," suggested teacher. "Oh, very poor. They didn't have anything to eat for 3 days and just would have died," the doctor said, "if I didn't bring them that pie."
"That was such a tiny pie," commented teacher gently, "to save two lives." Francie knew then that she had gone too far. She hated whatever that thing was inside her that made her invent such whoppers. Teacher bent down and put her arms around Francie. Francie saw that there were tears in her eyes. Francie went to pieces, and remorse rose in her like bitter flood waters.
"That's all a big lie," she confessed. "I ate the pie myself."
"I know you did."
"Don't send a letter home," begged Francie, thinking of the address she didn't own. "I'll stay after school every day for..."
"I'll not punish you for having an imagination." Gently, teacher explained the difference between a lie and a story. A lie was something you told because you were mean or a coward. A story was something you made up out of something that might have happened, only you didn't tell it like it was. You told it like you thought it should have been. As teacher talked, a great trouble left Francie. Lately, she had been given to exaggerating things. She did not report happenings truthfully, but gave them color, excitement, and dramatic twists. Katie was annoyed at this tendency and kept warning Francie to tell the plain truth and to stop romancing. But Francie just couldn't tell the plain, undecorated truth. She had to put something to it. Although Katie had the same flair for coloring and incident, and Johnny himself lived in a half-dream world, yet they tried to squelch these things in their child. Maybe they had a good reason. Maybe they knew their own gift of imagination colored too rosily the poverty and brutality of their lives and made them able to endure it. Perhaps Katie thought that if they did not have this faculty, they would be clearer-minded, see things as they really were, and seeing them loathe them and somehow find a way to make them better. Francie always remembered what that kind teacher told her. "You know, Francie, a lot of people would think that these stories that you're making up all the time were terrible lies because they are not the truth as people see the truth. In the future, when something comes up, you tell exactly how it happened, but write down for yourself the way you think it should have happened. Tell the truth and write the story. Then you won't get mixed up." It was the best advice Francie ever got. Truth and fancy were so mixed up in her mind, as they are in the mind of every lonely child, that she didn't know which was which. But teacher made these two things clear to her. From that time on, she wrote little stories about things she saw and felt and did. In time, she got so that she was able to speak the truth with but a slight and instinctive coloring of the facts. Francie was 10 years old when she first found an outlet in writing. What she wrote was of little consequence. What was important was that the attempt to write stories kept her straight on the dividing line between truth and fiction. If she had not found this outlet in writing, she might have grown up to be a tremendous liar. Christmas was a charmed time in Brooklyn. It was in the air long before it came. The first hint of it was Mr. Morton going around the schools teaching Christmas carols, but the first sure sign was the store windows. You have to be a child to know how wonderful is a store window filled with dolls and sleds and other toys. And this wonder came free to Francie. It was nearly as good as actually having the toys, to be permitted to look at them through the glass window. Oh, what a thrill there was for Francie when she turned a street corner and saw another store all fixed up for Christmas. Ah, the clean, shining window with cotton batting sprinkled with stardust for a carpet. There were flaxen-haired dolls and others which Francie liked better, who had hair the color of good coffee with lots of cream in it. Their faces were perfectly tinted, and they wore clothes like of which Francie had never seen on Earth. The dolls stood upright in flimsy cardboard boxes. They stood with the help of a bit of tape passed around the neck and ankles and through holes at the back of the box. Oh, the deep blue eyes framed by thick lashes that stared straight into a little girl's heart, and the perfect miniature hands extended appealingly, asking, "Please, won't you be my mama?" And Francie had never had a doll except a 2-inch one that cost a nickel. And the sleds, or as the Williamsburg children called them, the sleighs, there was a child's dream of heaven come true. A new sled with a flower someone had dreamed up painted on it, a deep blue flower with bright green leaves. The ebony black painted runners, the smooth steering bar made of hard wood and gleaming varnish over all, and the names painted on them, Rosebud, Magnolia, Snow King, the Flyer, thought Francie. If I could only have one of those, I'd never ask God for another thing as long as I live. There were roller skates made of shining nickel with straps of good brown leather and silvered nervous wheels, tensed for rolling, needing but a breath to start them turning as they lay crossed one over the other, sprinkled with mica snow on a bed of cloud-like cotton. There were other marvelous things. Francie couldn't take them all in. Her head spun, and she was dizzy with the impact of all the seeing and all the making up of stories about the toys in the shop windows. The spruce trees began coming into the neighborhood the week before Christmas. Their branches were corded to hold back the glory of their spreading and probably to make shipping easier. Vendors rented space on the curb before a store and stretched a rope from pole to pole and leaned the trees against it. All day they walked up and down this one-sided avenue of aromatic-leaning trees, blowing on stiff, ungloved fingers and looking with bleak hope at those people who paused. A few ordered a tree set aside for the day. Others stopped to price, inspect, and conjecture. But most came just to touch the boughs and surreptitiously pinch a fingerful of spruce needles together to release the fragrance. And the air was cold and still, and full of the pine smell and the smell of tangerines which appeared in the stores only at Christmas time, and the mean street was truly wonderful for a little while. There was a cruel custom in the neighborhood. It was about the trees still unsold when midnight of Christmas Eve approached. There was a saying that if you waited until then, you wouldn't have to buy a tree, that they'd chuck 'em at you. This was literally true. At midnight on the eve of our dear Savior's birth, the kids gathered where there were unsold trees, the man threw each tree in turn, starting with the biggest. Kids volunteered to stand up against the throwing. If a boy didn't fall down under the impact, the tree was his. If he fell, he forfeited his chance at winning a tree. Only the roughest boys and some of the young men elected to be hit by the big trees. The others waited shrewdly until a tree came up that they could stand against. The little kids waited for the tiny, foot-high trees and shrieked in delight when they won one. On the Christmas Eve, when Francie was 10 and Neely 9, Mama consented to let them go down and have their first try for a tree. Francie had picked out her tree earlier in the day. She had stood near it all afternoon and evening praying that no one would buy it. To her joy, it was still there at midnight. It was the biggest tree in the neighborhood, and its price was so high that no one could afford to buy it. It was 10 feet high. Its branches were bound with new white rope, and it came to a sure, pure point at the top. The man took this tree out first. Before Francie could speak up, a neighborhood bully, a boy of 18 known as Punky Perkins, stepped forward and ordered the man to chuck the tree at him. The man hated the way Punky was so confident. He looked around and asked, "Anybody else want to take a chance on it?" Francie stepped forward. "Me, mister." A spurt of derisive laughter came from the tree man. The kids snickered. A few adults who had gathered to watch the fun guffawed.
"Oh, go on, you're too little," the tree man objected.
"Me and my brother, we're not too little together."
She pulled Neely forward. The man looked at them, a thin girl of 10 with starveling hollows in her cheeks, but with the chin still baby round. He looked at the little boy with his fair hair and round blue eyes. Neely Nolan, all innocence and trust.
"Two ain't fair," yelped Punky. "Shut your lousy trap," advised the man who held all power in that hour. "These here kids has got nerve. Stand back, the rest of yous. These kids is gonna have a show at this tree."
The others made a wavering lane. Francie and Neely stood at one end of it, and the big man with the big tree at the other. It was a human funnel with Francie and her brother making the small end of it.
The man flexed his great arms to throw the great tree. He noticed how tiny the children looked at the end of the short lane. For the split part of a moment, the tree thrower went through a kind of Gethsemane.
Oh, Jesus Christ, his soul agonized. Why don't I just give him the tree, sing Merry Christmas, and let him go? What's the tree to me? I can't sell it no more this year, and it won't keep till next year.
The kids watched him solemnly as he stood there in his moment of thought. But then, he rationalized, if I did that, all the other would expect to get him handed to him, and next year nobody at all would buy a tree off of me. They'd all wait to get him handed to him on a silver plate. I ain't a big enough man to give this tree away for nothing. No, I ain't big enough. I ain't big enough to do a thing like that. I gotta think of myself and my own kids. He finally came to his conclusion. Now, what the hell? Them two kids has gotta live in this world. They gotta get used to it. They gotta learn to give and to take punishment. And by Jesus, it ain't give but take all the time in this goddamn world. As he threw the tree with all his strength, his heart wailed out. It's a goddamn rotten, lousy world. Francie saw the tree leave his hands. There was a split bit of being when time and space had no meaning. The whole world stood still as something dark and monstrous came through the air. The tree came towards her, blotting out all memory of her ever having lived. There was nothing, nothing but pungent darkness, and something that grew and grew as it rushed at her. She staggered as the tree hit them. Neely went to his knees, but she pulled him up fiercely before he could go down. There was a mighty swishing sound as the tree settled. Everything was dark, green, and prickly. Then she felt a sharp pain at the side of her head, where the trunk of the tree had hit her. She felt Neely trembling. When some of the older boys pulled the tree away, they found Francie and her brother standing upright, hand in hand. Blood was coming from scratches on Neely's face. He looked more like a baby than ever, with his bewildered blue eyes and the fairness of his skin made more noticeable because of the clear red blood. But they were smiling. Had they not won the biggest tree in the neighborhood? Some of the boys hollered, "Hooray!" A few adults clapped. The tree man eulogized them by screaming, "And now get the hell out of here with your tree, you lousy bastards!" Francie had heard swearing since she had heard words. Obscenity and profanity had no meaning as such among those people. They were emotional expressions of inarticulate people with small vocabularies. They made a kind of dialect. The phrases could mean many things according to the expression and tone used in saying them. So now, when Francie heard themselves called lousy bastards, she smiled tremulously at the kind man. She knew that he was really saying, "Goodbye. God bless you." It wasn't easy dragging that tree home. They had to pull it inch by inch. They were handicapped by a boy who ran alongside yelping, "Free ride, all aboard," who'd jump on and make them drag him along. But he got sick of the game eventually and went away. In a way, it was good that it took them so long to get the tree home. It made their triumph more drawn out. Francie glowed when she heard a lady say, "I never saw such a big tree." A man called after them, "You kids must have robbed a bank to buy such a big tree." The cop on their corner stopped them, examined the tree, and solemnly offered to buy it for 10 cents. 15 cents, if they delivered it to his home. Francie Neely burst with pride, although she knew he was joking. She said she wouldn't sell it for a dollar even. He shook his head and said she was foolish not to grab the offer. He went up to a quarter, but Francie kept smiling and shaking her head. No. It was like acting in a Christmas play, where the setting was a street corner, and the time a frosty Christmas Eve, and the characters a kind cop, her brother, and herself. Francie knew all the dialogue. The cop gave his lines right, and Francie picked up her cues happily, and the stage directions with the smiles between the spoken lines. They had to call up to Papa to help them get the tree up the narrow stairs. Papa came running down. To Francie's relief, he ran down straight, and not sidewise, which proved that he was still sober. Papa's amazement at the size of the tree was flattering. He pretended to believe that it wasn't theirs. Francie had a lot of fun convincing him, although she knew all the while that the whole thing was make-believe. Papa pulled in front, and Francie and Neely pushed in back, and they began forcing the big tree up the 3 narrow flights of stairs. Johnny was so excited that he started singing, not caring that it was rather late at night. He sang "Holy Night."
The narrow walls took up his clear, sweet voice, held it for a breath, and gave it back with doubled sweetness. Doors creaked open and families gathered on the landings, pleased and amazed at the something unexpected being added to that moment of their lives.